he and Jefferson had discovered, and about the mastodons he and Jefferson believed might still inhabit the prairies. One last thing Lewis got in Philadelphia, his traveling library. It included Barton's Elements of Botany, which was not a gift. Lewis paid $6 for it. Lewis borrowed a book from Barton, Antoine Simore Lepage Duprat's History of Louisiana. He had Richard Kirwan's Elements of Mineralogy, London, 1784, a two-volume edition of Linnaeus, the founder of the system of Latin classification of plants, and a four-volume dictionary, along with a practical introduction to spherics and nautical astronomy, and the nautical almanac and astronomical ephemeris, together with tables necessary to finding latitude and longitude. On May 29th, Lewis sent a long-overdue report to Jefferson. He announced that on June 6th or 7th, he would be able to depart for Washington for a final conference, then would be off. He would have all his preparations completed in a day or two, but wanted to stay on an extra few days for additional study with Patterson. He enclosed some tracings he had made of Vancouver's map of the northwestern coast. He explained why a tracing rather than the original. The maps attached to Vancouver's voyage cannot be procured separately from that work, which is both too costly and too weighty for me either to purchase or carry. Geographer John Logan Allen points out that it took considerable cartographic technique to copy the charts from Vancouver's work. Lewis, Allen writes, was not simply a passive receptor of the geographical materials being assembled by Jefferson and Gallatin. It seems, rather, that he was active in gathering data for the purpose of taking it along on the expedition. Dr. Allen further speculates, on the basis of internal evidence, that Lewis made a copy of the David Thompson map of the Great Bend of the Missouri River, done late in the last century and in the possession of the British Chargé d'Affaires in Washington. During the second week in June, Lewis abandoned his original plan to go by Southwest Post. He had heard there were too few good men in the garrison and that no boat would be waiting in Nashville. So he arranged transportation by the Army, at the Army's expense, for 3,500 pounds of goods to be moved from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. Because the road which from necessity they must travel is by no means good, Lewis ordered a 5-horse team to pull the wagon. Apparently, it was also at this time that he entered into a contract with a boat builder in Pittsburgh. Then he set off for Washington. Probably foremost in Lewis's mind was the size of the party, along with an inevitable need for a second officer. None had been mentioned, but Lewis wanted one. If Jefferson approved, Lewis had a candidate in mind, as well as a highly unusual command arrangement. The president and the captain also needed to go over the final instructions in detail. Jefferson needed to bring Lewis up to date on the status of the proposed purchase of New Orleans. The two men had a lot to talk about before Lewis headed west. Chapter 8. Washington to Pittsburgh, June to August, 1803. When Lewis arrived in Washington, he and Jefferson went to work immediately on the instructions. Jefferson had circulated them among his cabinet and had their replies to consider. Secretary of State James Madison had wondered, if the laws give any authority at present beyond the limits of the U.S.? That was a shorthand way of raising the point that this expedition was going into territory belonging to France and administered by Spain, whose governments might regard it as a military reconnaissance or even an invasion. Attorney General Levi Lincoln warned Jefferson that, because of the perverse, hostile, and malignant state of the opposition, with their facility of imposing on the public mind and producing excitements, every measure originating with the executive will be attacked with a virulence, including the expedition. For his part, Lincoln declared, I consider the enterprise of national consequence. But as a politician, Lincoln knew that more justification was needed to keep the Federalist from howling at the cost. He came up with a rationale that would appeal to the New England clergy, advertise the thing as a mission to elevate the religious beliefs of the heathen Indians. If the enterprise appears to be an attempt to advance them, it will, by many people, on that account, be justified, however calamitous the issue. Jefferson bought the idea. In his final instructions, he ordered Lewis to learn what he could about Indian religion, because it would help those who may endeavor to civilize and instruct them. Lincoln had another important suggestion. Jefferson had written that if Lewis were faced with certain destruction, he should retreat rather than offer opposition. Lincoln commented, "From my ideas of Captain Lewis, he will be much more likely, in case of difficulty, to push too far rather than to recede too soon. Would it not be well to change the term certain destruction into probable destruction, and to add that these dangers are never to be encountered, which vigilance, precaution, and attention can secure against at a reasonable expense?" There is more than a hint here that Lincoln was one of the president's advisers who feared Lewis was a reckless risk-taker, one of those Virginia gentlemen who would overreact to any challenge to his honor or bravery. Jefferson may have agreed. In any event, he adopted the wording Lincoln suggested. Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin saw nothing in Jefferson's draft that needed changing, but he did want some things added. He wanted to know more about the Spanish posts in Louisiana and the British activities along the Missouri River. "The future destinies of the Missouri country are of vast importance to the U.S., Gallatin wrote, "it being perhaps the only large tract of country, and certainly the first, which, lying out of the boundaries of the Union, will be settled by the people of the United States." Therefore, he wanted as much information as possible on the Missouri drainage. As the instructions indicated, Jefferson had a multitude of motives for sending off the expedition, but number one for him was the all-water route to the Pacific. Not for Gallatin. He flatly stated, "The great object is to ascertain whether, from its extent and fertility, the Missouri country is susceptible of a large population, in the same manner as the corresponding tract on the Ohio." He wanted Lewis enjoined to describe the soil and make judgments on its fertility by noticing the prevailing species of timber, to assess annual rainfall, temperature extremes, and other factors important to farmers. Jefferson adopted most of Gallatin's suggestions, but in its final form, the instructions issued by Commander-in-Chief Jefferson to Captain Meriwether Lewis put exploration and commerce ahead of agriculture. "The object of your mission," Jefferson wrote, "is to explore the Missouri River and such principal stream of it as, by its course and communication with the waters of the Pacific Ocean, whether the Columbia, Oregon, Colorado, or any other river, may offer the most direct and practicable water communication across this continent for the purposes of commerce." Commerce being the principal object, Jefferson naturally wanted Lewis to learn what he could about the routes used by the British traders coming down from Canada to trade with the Missouri River tribes, and about their trading methods and practice. He wanted Lewis to make suggestions as to how the fur trade, currently dominated by the British, could be taken over by Americans using the Missouri route. Good maps were essential to commerce, so Jefferson's orders read, "Beginning at the mouth of the Missouri, you will take careful observations of latitude and longitude at all remarkable points on the river, and especially at the mouths of rivers, at rapids, at islands, and other places and objects distinguished by such natural marks and characters of a durable kind." Jefferson admonished Lewis to write his figures and observations distinctly and intelligibly, and to make multiple copies, one of these to be on the paper of the birch, as less liable to injury from damp than common paper. The fur trade would require knowledge of the Indian tribes. Jefferson instructed Lewis to learn the names of the nations and their numbers, the extent of their possessions, their relations with other tribes, their languages, traditions, monuments, their occupations, whether agriculture or fishing or hunting or war, and the implements they used for those activities, their food, clothing, and housing, the diseases prevalent among them, and the remedies they used, their laws and customs, and last on the list, but first in importance, articles of commerce they may need or furnish, and to what extent. This was an ethnographer's dream-come-true set of marching orders. "In all your intercourse with the natives," Jefferson went on, "treat them in the most friendly and conciliatory manner which their own conduct will admit. Lewis should satisfy them of your journey's innocence, but simultaneously tell them of the size and strength of the United States. He should temper that implied threat by assuring the tribes of our wish to be neighborly and of our peaceful intentions. Americans only wish to trade with them. Lewis should invite a few chiefs to come to Washington for a visit and arrange for some Indian children to come to the United States and be brought up with us and taught such arts as may be useful to them." On the distinct possibility of an Indian attack, Jefferson was specific. "If faced by a superior force determined to stop the expedition, you must decline its further pursuit and return. In the loss of yourselves, we should lose also the information you will have acquired. To your own discretion, therefore, must be left the degree of danger you may risk, and the point at which you should decline, only saying we wish you to err on the side of your safety, and to bring back your party safe, even if it be with less information. Jefferson told Lewis that, on the accident of your death, you are hereby authorized to name the person who shall succeed to the command. When Lewis reached the Pacific coast, he should seek out a European trading vessel and possibly sail back to the United States on it. Or he could send back a copy of the journals with two men, if he wished, and return by the route he had come. Taken altogether, the military section of Jefferson's orders was all that a company commander setting off on an expedition could hope for. He had the authority he needed, including the specific permission from the commander-in-chief to make his judgments in the field. Jefferson realized that when Lewis reached the Pacific, you will be without money, clothes, or provisions. To deal with that situation, Jefferson provided a letter of credit for Lewis, authorizing him to draw on any agency of the U.S. government anywhere in the world, anything he wanted. I also ask of the consuls, agents, merchants, and citizens of any nation to furnish you with those supplies which your necessities may call for, and to give more entire satisfaction and confidence to those who may be disposed to aid you, I, Thomas Jefferson, President of the United States of America, have written this letter of general credit for you with my own hand and signed it with my name. In its final version, dated July 4, 1803, this must be the most unlimited letter of credit ever issued by an American president. Beyond commerce, the purpose of the expedition was to discover flora and fauna. The instructions ordered Lewis to notice and comment on the soil, the plant and animal life, especially plants not known in the United States, dinosaur bones, and volcanoes. Jefferson wanted to know about mineral productions of every kind, but the ones he listed were limestone, pit coal, and salt. There is no direct order to keep a daily journal. Jefferson did write about the possibility of sending Indians down the Missouri to St. Louis, carrying letters and a copy of your journal, notes, and observations, the only use of the word journal in the instructions, and he did tell Lewis to send a copy of your notes by sea if he could, but there is no order about journal keeping. Perhaps it was a taken-for-granted matter. Perhaps, in their many long discussions about the instructions, Jefferson made the order orally. Donald Jackson's description of Jefferson's instructions cannot be bettered. They embrace years of study and wonder, the collected wisdom of his government colleagues and his Philadelphia friends. They barely conceal his excitement at realizing that at last he would have facts, not vague guesses, about the Stony Mountains, the river courses, the wild Indian tribes, the flora and fauna of untrodden places. As they talked about the instructions, Lewis and Jefferson also discussed such matters as when Lewis could get going, what additional instruments and maps he would need, the size of the party and additional supplies, what the War Department could contribute to the expedition, and the negotiations over Louisiana. All these subjects were intermingled. They came together in the need for another officer. Recognition of that need evidently came simultaneously. It certainly came naturally. The arguments for such an appointment were overwhelming. The instructions called for information in so many areas that one man could hardly provide it all and certainly could not do it all well. It was plain common sense to have two officers, so that if something happened to one, the other could bring back the maps, scientific discoveries, descriptions of the Indians encountered, and all the rest. A second officer would be a help in enforcing discipline and in fighting Indians if it came to that. There was no good reason not to take a second officer, except cost. And since Jefferson had just authorized spending millions of dollars for New Orleans, and he had his whole heart and mind invested in the Lewis expedition, he wasn't going to let cost be a factor. Jefferson opened the coffers of the War Department for Lewis, acting in his capacity as commander-in-chief in support of an expedition sanctioned by Congress. In the process, he stretched the Constitution considerably, but penny-pinching the expedition was worse than bending his strict constructionist principles. He told the War Department to pay Lewis an 18-month advance in his salary, possibly for land speculation or to pay off debts. Lewis also borrowed $108 from Jefferson. Secretary of War Henry Dearborn had sent an order to Harper's Ferry to supply anything Lewis requested in the way of arms and ironwork, with the least possible delay. Jefferson saw to it that Lewis had unlimited purchasing power. The chief clerk of the War Department received orders to purchase when requested by Lewis such articles as he may have occasion for, which he has not been able to obtain from the public stores. And the Treasury Department was ordered to turn over $1,000 for Lewis's goods. Even with some smoke and mirrors bookkeeping, the cost overrun was now at 100% and growing daily. Making the selections took time. Jefferson had hoped that Lewis would be off by June 28th or even earlier, but the day came and went and Lewis still had much to do. Nevertheless, Lewis expected to be on the Missouri by September 1st, which would give him 2 traveling months, during which he hoped to go 700 or even 800 miles up the Missouri before going into winter quarters. On June 29th, Dearborn ordered the Army paymaster to give Lewis $554. Being 6 months' pay for 1 lieutenant, 1 sergeant, 1 corporal, and 10 privates. That amounted to Lewis's official authorization to add an officer. Lewis had already acted on it because Jefferson had agreed within a day or so of Lewis's arrival in Washington that it had to be done. On June 19th, Lewis had written to William Clark. The letter contained what Donald Jackson described as one of the most famous invitations to greatness the nation's archives can provide. It is a critical document. It launched one of the great friendships of all time and started the friends on one of the great adventures and one of the great explorations of all time. It is also revealing. Lewis and Clark have become so entwined by history that for many Americans the name is Lewis and Clark, but in 1803 they were not intimate friends. Although Clark was born in Virginia 4 years earlier than Lewis, he had moved to Kentucky as a small boy. They knew each other only in the Army for 6 months when Lewis had served under Clark. No anecdotes survive or any correspondence between them in the next decade except for a business letter from Lewis to Clark, asking him to make inquiries about land in Ohio. But in that 6 months together, they had taken each other's measure. That they liked what they saw is obvious from Lewis's letter to Clark and Clark's response. They complimented each other. Clark was a tough woodsman accustomed to command. He had been a company commander and had led a party down the Mississippi as far as Natchez. He had a way with enlisted men without ever getting familiar. He was a better terrestrial surveyor than Lewis and a better waterman. Lewis apparently knew of his map-making ability. In general, in areas in which Lewis was shaky, Clark was strong, and vice versa. Most of all, Lewis knew that Clark was competent to the task, that his word was his bond, that his back was steel. Clark knew the same about Lewis. Their trust in each other was complete, even before they took the first step west together. How this closeness came about cannot be known in any detail, but that it clearly was there long before the expedition cannot be doubted. Clark had retired from the Army in 1796, partly for reasons of health, partly to try his hand in business, mainly to do something to help straighten out the terribly tangled financial affairs of his older brother, General George Rogers Clark. He was living in Clarksville, Indiana Territory, when Lewis's letter arrived. Lewis opened his invitation thus. From the long and uninterrupted friendship and confidence which has subsisted between us, I feel no hesitation in making to you the following communication. He described the origins of the expedition, the congressional action, what he had done in Harper's Ferry and Philadelphia to get ready, and his intention to set out for Pittsburgh at the end of June. He thought he would be in Clarksville to meet Clark about August 10th. On the way, he intended to find and engage some good hunters, stout, healthy, unmarried men, accustomed to the woods and capable of bearing bodily fatigue in a pretty considerable degree. Should any young men answering this description be found in your neighborhood, I would thank you to give information of them on my arrival at the Falls of the Ohio. Lewis described the expedition in matter-of-fact language that may well have left Clark breathless. My plan is to descend the Ohio in a keeled boat, thence up the Mississippi to the mouth of the Missouri, and up that river as far as its navigation is practicable with a keeled boat, there to prepare canoes of bark or rawhides, and proceed to its, the Missouri's, source, and, if practicable, pass over to the waters of the Columbia or Oregon River, and by descending it, reach the Western Ocean. Lewis wrote that he would return to the United States on a trading vessel, if possible. He gave Clark a summary of his instructions from Jefferson and described the instruments he had collected for making observations. To carry out the mission, Lewis said he had authorization from Jefferson to pick non-commissioned officers and men, not to exceed 12, from the Western Army posts. He added that he was also authorized to engage any other man, not soldiers, that I may think useful in promoting the objects of success of this expedition. He had in mind hunters, guides, and interpreters. "Thus, my friend," Lewis concluded, "you have a summary view of the plan, the means, and the objects of this expedition. If, therefore, there is anything under those circumstances in this enterprise which would induce you to participate with me in its fatigues, its dangers, and its honors, believe me, there is no man on earth with whom I should feel equal pleasure in sharing them as with yourself." Lewis wrote that he had talked with Jefferson about the offer and that the president expresses an anxious wish that you would consent to join me in this enterprise. There followed the most extraordinary offer. "He, Jefferson, has authorized me to say that in the event of your accepting this proposition, he will grant you a captain's commission, which of course will entitle you to the pay and emoluments attached to that office, and will equally with myself entitle you to such portion of land as was granted to officers of similar rank for their revolutionary services. Your situation, if joined with me in this mission, will in all respects be precisely such as my own." It was remarkable for Lewis to propose a co-command. He did not even have to add a lieutenant to the party, and most certainly did not have to share the command. Divided command almost never works.